It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, flu cases are on the rise in Wisconsin. We'll learn what could be causing that spike.
First, two candidates are vying for Wisconsin's top education job. Tony Evers has served as the state superintendent for the Department of Public Instruction since 2009. He's running for re-election. He's challenged by former district superintendent Lowell Holtz.
And last night, both candidates attended a public forum where they spoke on issues including the impact of Act 10, school voucher funding, and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos.
Molly Beck joins us now. She's the Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she covered that forum last night. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, tell us about the forum. This is not one of those really high-profile races in Wisconsin. Were people there? Was this a lively event?
There were a few people there. It was mostly other school district superintendents. There were a couple of former candidates in the superintendent race over the years. Dan Mobley, he was there. Jeff Holmes, who's the Germantown School District superintendent who dropped out of this race, he was there. The write-in candidate from Racine, Rick Melcher, he was there too. There's a number of, you know, school-related organizations, representatives from them were there too. So it was a pretty small group, but interested group.
Can you talk about the range of issues that they covered there?
Sure. They talked a lot about, the effect of Governor Scott Walker's law, Act 10, that related to collective bargaining and its effect on school districts and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. And they disagreed on that. The candidate, Will Holtz, who is a former Whitnall superintendent, he said that as a superintendent that law helped him stop laying off teachers, while incumbent Tony Evers said that law has turned off what he said was an entire generation of future teachers. So they disagreed on that. They agreed on repealing the state law that requires the school year start date to be September 1st. And they also talked a little bit about funding and the state's school voucher systems and Donald Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos.
Let's get into Act 10 a little bit. And the idea of a teacher shortage, at least at some Wisconsin schools, in some specialty areas in particular. Tony Evers, you were saying connecting dots between Act 10 and a possible teacher shortage, future and present, or present and future.
Right. I think research shows that the declining enrollment in teacher preparation programs in colleges and universities in Wisconsin does reflect a nationwide trend, but he did say that Act 10 had an effect on that. He said that he believes that it has kind of politicized that profession and people are less interested in entering it because of that. So he's concerned that law may have turned off some people to that profession because of it.
And another issue that the two candidates have disagreed on in the past has to do with funding for voucher schools as an alternative to private school or to public schools. What kind of things do we hear at the forum about that?
Sure. Tony Evers, he said that he does not like the way the expansion of the state voucher system has been paid for. So he does not want the expansion to be, quote, at the expense of public schools. While candidate Will Holtz, he's very supportive of school vouchers and school choice. They both did agree that both schools, you know, public schools and private voucher schools should be measured the same and required to report the same kind of data. So the accountability systems are the same, but they did disagree on whether this system should be expanded or not.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at last night's forum in the race for superintendent of public instruction in Wisconsin, the state's top job in education. Molly, let's take a look at what they had to say. They were, had their eyes on Washington a little bit and the new education secretary at the federal level, Betsy DeVos. What was some of the back and forth there?
Sure. Will Holtz, he said that he doesn't know too much about her, but he said that he is encouraged by the things that Donald Trump has been saying about returning some power back to states and school districts in determining how they want to approach education. And he said if she delivers on that, he would be very, very supportive of her. Tony Evers said that he thinks that he is more qualified for that job than she is, and also said that he is concerned about what kind of advocacy she will be doing and whether she will be advocating for public schools as well as private voucher schools, which she has, you know, worked for many years to expand across the country.
Any other issues that came up that they agreed or disagreed on that struck you?
So, something that came up after the forum was this whole controversy over the campaign-related email use that a liberal advocacy group, One Wisconsin Now, has released some emails showing that Will Holtz has done some campaign work on his school district account when he was superintendent of the Whitnall School District. And when they were talking about that, he pushed reporters to cover the Tony Evers had done the same thing in his 2009 race. So that was something that came up after the forum that they spoke at length about.
And then this is all after the thing with Lowell Holtz and the candidate who didn't make the cut in the primary. They had the weird back and forth about supposed job offers if they dropped out of the race.
Right. That didn't actually come up at this forum at all. There weren't any questions about it. And really, the focus on the so-called controversy was mostly on these campaign-related emails. But that certainly has been, an issue that the Evers campaign has hammered down on, that the controversy of the job offer in exchange for dropping out of the race and take over school district.
Now, this is the only contested statewide race. We have officially a race for the state Supreme Court. There is one candidate in that race, the incumbent. As a state capitol reporter, is there a lot of buzz about this, or is this just kind of a quiet election season from where the capitol is concerned?
Sure. It had been very quiet up until just a couple weeks ago when a third candidate, John Humphreys, released this document that showed he and Lowell Holtz had discussed this proposal that he said was from Lowell Holtz that, would offer this job at DPI if one of them got elected in exchange for dropping out of the race. Since then, it's been, there's been a lot of focus on this race because of that and a lot of interest. But other than that, not really. You saw the voter turnout in the primary election less than 10%.
And then what do you think we might see from the candidates between now and Election Day, April 4th? Are there more forums? Are we expecting to see lots of campaign advertising, maybe from outside groups?
Right. That remains to be seen. I tried to do a story on that a few days ago, and I talked to some groups that may spend in that race, and they were pretty quiet on whether they had decided to do that or not. I think, you'll see a few ads, but I'm not sure that you'll see a whole lot of new forums or debates. There's a couple scheduled, but we'll see how it shakes out.
And I will say, a couple weeks before the election, the Joy Cardine Show is looking to host both of the candidates. I don't have an exact date on that, but watch this space. And Molly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Molly Beck. She's state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about the race for state superintendent for the Department of Public Instruction. There was a forum that the two candidates held last night. The general election for the state superintendent, again, is on April 4th. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, cases of the flu are on the rise in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a state epidemiologist about why there's an increase and how people can take care of themselves.
First, not everything state government does is easy to grasp, but people notice roads. Politicians celebrate new roads at ribbon cuttings, and they catch flack from their voters when roads go bad.
But the push to build bigger and better roads has come with a cost that's getting harder and harder for the government to pay. As Sean Johnson reports in our second installment of a week-long series on transportation, projects like a plan to expand Interstate 3990 between Beloit and Madison are under the microscope.
Drivers on a stretch of Interstate 3990 near the Wisconsin-Illinois border can see firsthand what a few years and a few billion dollars will do for a state when it comes to building highways. The Illinois side of the interstate is six lanes of concrete. It's flat, well lit, and it's finished. As drivers cross the state border on their way to Wisconsin, they immediately merge to a four-lane highway. The pavement is rougher. Construction equipment sits dormant for winter. Chunks of concrete and rebar litter some ditches. Truckers stopped at the Wisconsin Welcome Center just north of the border have mixed feelings on the state of Wisconsin roads. Bob Schrader hauls RVs for a company in Manitoba.
They're an expensive unit, and you want to get them home without having them all shook to pieces. And there is a section of road here that could stand some repair, yes.
Schrader says he's not ready to avoid this stretch of Wisconsin roads yet.
Probably not, but eventually there is another road. It might be a little further, but, you know, there's always another way to get there.
Other truck drivers say Wisconsin's roads compare well to other states. Courtney Sunkin is from Michigan.
Oh, I think they're good. Yeah, top notch. I mean, Michigan needs to learn something.
How drivers view Wisconsin roads depends a lot on where they're going and where they've been. But Wisconsin communities view roads through a different lens. Dan Cunningham with the group Forward Janesville has been pushing to expand Interstate 3990 for nearly a decade. Cunningham calls this stretch of road Wisconsin's front porch. And as he looks at it from the side of an overpass, he sees room for improvement.
It's funny, when you cross the Wisconsin border, there might as well be a sign saying, "Welcome to Wisconsin, here's where the modern highway infrastructure ends." Because you get to Illinois and it's just three lanes of really smooth traffic heading down to Chicago. And then you get into Wisconsin and it's ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk.
Cunningham says completing this road project will help his city and his region grow. And even in today's hyper-partisan political climate, Republicans and Democrats have agreed. Democratic Governor Jim Doyle and Republican Governor Scott Walker both embraced the I-3990 expansion. State representatives like Republican Amy Loudenbeck of Clinton are fighting for the project now.
It's incredibly important to the district I represent in Rock County and also to the rest of the state.
State representatives like former Democratic Assembly Speaker Mike Sheridan of Janesville helped the project get off the ground.
Yeah, quite frankly, we can't afford not to do this.
But whether the state can afford more projects like this one is an open question. In 2011, the Interstate 3990 expansion was projected to cost $715 million. That number grew to $1.2 billion just 5 years later. And that doesn't include a $550 million rebuild of an interchange in Madison. Cost overruns like these have drawn sharp criticism from an unlikely coalition of conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity and environmental groups like 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin. Ashwat Narayanan is 1,000 Friends Transportation Policy Director.
It's not isolated just to this project. I think this is a pattern that we're seeing all across the state. I think we have to take one step back and maybe ask ourselves if all of the money that we're throwing into these huge projects are actually necessary.
A recent report from the Nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau found the price tag for 16 ongoing major highway projects had grown by more than $3 billion, and the state is now borrowing more to pay for them. It's why big highway projects that were easy to approve years ago are no longer a given today. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find this and other stories in the series at WPR.org/roads.
Now it's the one season that we can safely guess no one looks forward to, flu season. And Wisconsin has seen a spike in the last month in confirmed cases of the flu throughout the state.
Our next guest tells us why there's been a significant rise in the flu in Wisconsin and what people can do to take care of themselves as influenza makes the rounds.
Tom Haupt is with us now. He's the Wisconsin Influenza Surveillance Coordinator and epidemiologist for the State Department of Health Services. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, Veronica.
How widespread is the flu in Wisconsin this year?
We're seeing it throughout each of the five public health regions. Obviously, we're seeing a few more cases in the more heavily populated areas like Milwaukee County and Dane County. But prospectively, we're seeing high incidence throughout the state, right around peak activity through statewide.
How does that compare to last year?
Last year was a little bit of a later year, and it was a different type of virus. Last year we had the influenza A H1 virus, which predominantly hit and affected the younger population, young adults more so than this year's influenza virus, which is an H3, which really tends to affect the older population more. Last year we peaked in March, where, as I said, we're right about at peak activity now. It's a little early to make that determination this week, but early indications are that even as early as last week, we may have reached our peaked activity, but we still continue to have very high numbers.
How did researchers do this year at matching the flu vaccine to the actual types of flu going around?
The influenza vaccine match was pretty good this year. We figured it was somewhere between 43 to 48%, which means you're 43 to 48% less likely to seek medical attention if you receive the influenza vaccine. Now, that a lot of people will say, oh, anything less than 100 is not acceptable. But again, you're dealing with a very strong virus here, and the H3 virus that is circulating in Wisconsin is very powerful. And if it, for the most part, it can prevent the complications, which is of influenza, which is pneumonia. Unfortunately, death is a complication, obviously. But again, it's been a pretty good match this year. It's about what we expect for this powerful of a virus.
And you said last year there were young people who were affected more predominantly than other groups of people. Who's affected this year?
This would be the older population. Again, being very careful of stereotyping, but what, for surveillance purposes, we say the elderly population over 65 years old. So obviously, the older you get, the more possibilities there are for complications. And that's because the older population does not get the full protection that a young adult would get. We want them to get the vaccine, but again, they just don't receive the protection that a younger adult gets. So they are more susceptible to complications. And we are seeing that. In all of our cases this year, we've had about 1,700, almost 1,800 hospitalizations. Over two-thirds of them have been over 65 years old.
Our technical director here on the show just got her flu shot. Is it likely to be effective, or are we peaking and it's going to be too late? What do you think?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be effective. All four strains of influenza are still circulating in Wisconsin. As I mentioned, we're probably at peak activity or maybe 1 week past, but we're still going to see very high numbers of influenza over the next few weeks. So it's definitely not too late to get the influenza vaccine. The sooner you get it, the more protection you get, the quicker you get it, and that usually is within the first couple weeks after you receive the vaccination.
Now, one thing that always seems to happen at flu season is the word flu gets bandied about quite a lot. People say the flu for almost everything. What is the flu? How do we know if we've got the actual flu?
Well, the flu itself is still short for influenza, which is a respiratory virus that's characterized by sudden onset of high fever, cough, sore throat, muscle aches, and then followed by a period of fatigue where you basically feel like you've been hit by a truck. You just can't get your energy back. I know people start talking about the stomach flu, which is more of a diarrheal type of illness. And we try to stay away from that. We try to make that distinction between flu being strictly respiratory and the gastrointestinal diarrheal types of illnesses. But again, we're right in the middle of our influenza, our respiratory season right now.
We're talking with Tom Haupt right now, Wisconsin Influenza Surveillance Coordinator and epidemiologist for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And we were talking about that vaccine. Is there a point, Tom, where you might say, you know what, don't bother, it's probably too late and flu season is over?
Well, it's hard to really say. I mean, in different parts of the country, especially if there's any travel involved, we always say if you have the vaccine and people have not received it, give it to the people who may need it. If they're traveling to places like Alaska or someplace like that where it's more indigenous of having influenza throughout the year, it's not going to hurt people to get the influenza vaccine. But what we try to do is we try to give people the most updated information about what's happening in Wisconsin, also to physicians, clinicians, so they can make the best determination as to when they no longer need to give the vaccine to their residents, to people who are ill. And a lot of it, again, is based on the fact that do they have a vaccine available? Has it been expired? Is it something we could still get some benefit from?
What can people do if they haven't got the flu, they've gotten their flu vaccine, and they just want to practice good personal hygiene and try not to get sick?
Right. Basically, if somebody's not feeling good, they need to give themselves a chance to recover, especially around this time of year. And with the warm weather we've had over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of pollen issues and people with allergies. And again, people might be mistaking allergies for an actual minor cases of influenza, which could be spread to other people. So if there's any kind of respiratory illness going around, whether it's a cough, sore throat, you have to look at it as possibility of something contagious like influenza, and you give yourself time to heal. And you don't want to go around people and visiting people who are older, like in a nursing home. We don't want to introduce the influenza into that population. You don't want to introduce it into children who might be in daycare. Yeah, the purpose of the vaccine is not only to protect yourselves, but to protect those people around you. And if you're not feeling well, give yourself a chance to heal. Rest, drink plenty of fluids.
What if you're not sick, but you have to kind of interact with somebody who is? What can you do preventively?
Right. In a case like that, I mean, if you really have to interact with someone who is not feeling right, it's very appropriate to wear a mask. It's just a surgical mask. Now, that can be worn by the person who is sick, or it also could be worn by the person who is being exposed. For example, if they go into a hospital and a person is sick, many times they will ask the visitors to wear a mask to protect themselves. So, but also good hand washing, good hygiene, those are the types of things that are going to protect you in addition to the influenza vaccine.
Tom, I, as we wrap up here, I've always wondered, you know, here we are in Wisconsin, it's cold this winter, it's especially wet and damp. Do we deal with more cases of things like influenza in Wisconsin because of our climate than, say, someone who's basking in sunny California?
It seems like we always have more cases than places like Arizona, Southern California, and there's a lot of research that is still pending as to what role the climate has on that. Certainly, we're much more cooped up with cold weather compared to some of these other states, but it also is a fact, too, that it seems like we have more cases up here than what they have. But again, we're continuing to do more research as to the effect of climate and how it might actually affect the numbers of cases and the complexity of the cases, especially in cold weather states like Wisconsin.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us and filling us in.
Thank you, Veronica. I appreciate the chance to be on your show.
Tom Haupt is the Wisconsin Influenza Surveillance Coordinator and Epidemiologist for the State Department of Health Services. He was with us there to talk about a recent spike in the number of flu cases here in Wisconsin.
Coming up after the news, our guest says we should spend more time talking to strangers because people we don't know can change our lives for the better. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to Wisconsin's Department of Corrections Secretary about the use of solitary confinement in youth prisons.
First, on any given day, we might see a lot of people we don't know well or know at all. People walking on the sidewalk, the neighbor from down the street, the clerk at the store, the delivery person at work. For the most part, we probably don't interact with them a whole lot.
Our next guest says that's a lot of missed opportunities and that if we talked to some of those strangers, our lives would be better and more interesting.
Keo Stark joins us now. She's the author of the book When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform Your Life. Keo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, I'm excited to be here.
What got you started, Keo, talking with strangers?
Oh, it's funny. I grew up in a family where really that was part of our culture. Everyone talked to strangers, and I was well into my probably mid-20s before I realized that this was not the way that everyone was raised, and it wasn't a completely universal sentiment that it was a good thing to talk to strangers. So that was when I really started to pay attention to why and what other people were doing.
In a nutshell, what do you think we get out of those interactions? I mean, in most cases, probably we don't become besties with the strangers that we talk to. So kind of what's in it for us?
Sure. So what I'm interested in actually has nothing to do with the becoming besties and getting close to people and, you know, repeated interactions. I'm really interested in these very specific fleeting moments. And I think that when you start to experience that and pay attention to it, you realize that you're getting a couple of really important things out of it. The first thing you're getting is a sense of intimacy. And this seems like a paradox because these are people you don't know very well. But when we talk about this need for closeness, for intimacy, we're talking in part about connectedness and belonging. And it's one of the really unusual and kind of exciting things about when you have a good interaction with a stranger, you have this momentary sense of belonging and connectedness. And this can come even from just exchanging a smile with someone on the street. You can certainly get it if you have a kind of more extended conversation. So that's one part of it. The other part of it that I think is really important is the way in which when we expose ourselves and open ourselves up to people who are different than we are, it really changes our understanding of them and kind of opens up our realm of social possibility.
Right. You write that there are political and social benefits, or there would be if more of us did this, if we talk to people who we don't know and people who are different than ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, the idea of talking to people who are different than we are has gained, since I wrote the book, such intense importance in, you know, the wake of the election and the kind of fear and prejudice that is really coming to flower, unfortunately, in a lot of parts of the country. So I think, you know, when we talk to a stranger who's different than we are, you get kind of forced to treat them and understand them as an individual with a context, with beliefs, with thoughts, with feelings, with emotions, and not as a member of a category, not as a stereotype. And that in and of itself, that focus on the individual really is a moment of possibility for all of us.
We've also been hearing over the past, I guess, decade or so that America is becoming a lonelier place. There was the book Bowling Alone, other mm-hmm. people writing about how people kind of live in their own little pods and don't bust out of them. They've got their earbuds in. Does this help treat loneliness the way we might feel separated from people?
I think it does in a lot of ways. I mean, when we talk about loneliness in that way of kind of isolation, I think we're talking about kind of alienation from a feeling of community. And the more that you do talk to strangers, to even just, you know, exchange smiles, greet people, say hello, that brings us back into a feeling of being part of a community, of kind of being in this together. And I think that does really cut back on one facet of this loneliness. And it's definitely the bowling alone kind of loneliness. You know, there's also the loneliness of the heart, you know, when somebody is separated from their family. And I think that's different.
We're talking about talking with strangers. Keo Stark is with us. Her book is When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform Your Life. Keo, we've talked about why talking to strangers can help us out. Let's get into how. Now, not all of us grew up like you, wanting to just talk to other people randomly. Some of us are maybe introverts or shy. How do we get started? How do we make some of the first steps toward talking to, you know, the person at the counter, the person on the bus, whatever?
Sure. So it's a great question. And, you know, it's all easy for me to say, go talk to strangers when it's a part of the great pleasure of my life. But yeah, I think one of the things, if you're, you know, just trying to change your orientation towards public space and make contact with people, is to first pay attention to how people do interact in the places where you're going and you know, coming across people. So you could take a walk and you don't have to talk to anybody, let's say through the park, but watch what people are doing and when they do say hello to each other and when they don't. And try to get a feeling of that, of what the kind of local rules are, to give yourself some confidence. Because we're all operating by these sort of unwritten rules of any given place. And once you can see them, they're invisible. We don't really talk about them, but we all know what they are. And once you start to see them, it gives you a lot more confidence. I think another thing, if you're nervous about like feeling awkward or feeling rejected, one of my favorite pieces of advice is just go somewhere where you're not in your ordinary path. So go to a different neighborhood or a different park than you usually go to, a different dog run, whatever it might be, and try it out there. Because if you feel awkward or any other kind of negative feeling, you're not going to see those people again. You know, you're not going to walk back by that park and have someone say like, oh, that's that weird person who said hello to me. There's one other thing that's really, really important, and that is having a sensitivity to people who don't want to be talked to. So there's a lot of context and a lot of reasons why somebody might want everyone to leave them alone. And the main signal of that is somebody who's not making eye contact. If people aren't making eye contact, just don't do it. Don't talk to them. You know, you're looking for people who are making eye contact, which is the way that somebody shows themselves to be open.
You were talking before about how you're interested in these moments of flash intimacy. Can you tell us a story or two where you actually feel like these conversations went well and you had that moment of feeling really connected with somebody?
Sure. I mean, you know, the other day, it's been kind of winter here. I'm in New York City. And everyone's, it's that point in winter where everyone's a little depressed and dreary. And I walked by somebody on my block and said hello to them. And there was a guy sitting on a stoop a few doors down. And he looked up and said hello. And he smiled and he was like, see, it's like dominoes. You say hello and then everybody says hello. And I was like, yes, that's exactly how it should work. Another thing that I've noticed lately in terms of longer conversations, you know, there's this sort of triteness of like, who wants to talk about the weather? The weather's boring. And I think there is a certain sort of social meaning to saying, oh, hey, it's a nice day, isn't it? It's just this basic acknowledgement. But a longer conversation, okay, nobody wants to talk about that. What I've found is if you talk about food, you get pretty much straight into like the meaning of life. this is not something I knew. This is something I've learned in the past like 6 weeks. I think I had several conversations. One guy was talking about it's a nice day for fishing. I said, do you fish? He's telling me how to cook the fish. He's talking about his entire worldview about health. Another guy, I told him I was a vegetarian, and we ended up getting into Islam and the slaughter of lambs and his political views. And he was from Egypt. You know, it's like it's some kind of mainline into people's a kind of openness about who people really are.
We're talking with Keo Stark right now. She's the author of When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. She says we get a lot out of talking to strangers.
And we want to hear from you about this at 800-642-1234. Do you talk to strangers? What kind of reactions do you get? And what, if anything, do you get out of it? Do you like it when people strike up conversations with you or even just say hi? Or would you rather not? And do you have questions for our guests about how to get started? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Keo Stark. She's the author of the book When Strangers Meet. She says we can get a lot out of talking to strangers, and she's sharing some advice on how to do it.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like to talk to strangers, or do you kind of go out of your way to avoid it? Have you learned something by striking up a conversation with somebody you didn't know? Or do you have questions for our guest about how to get started and give it a whirl talking to somebody who's a stranger? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Anthony is with us in Green Bay. Anthony, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Anthony?
I just wanted to tell you about my experience with talking with strangers. I know a lot of times people don't enjoy engaging in conversation, but I really think it's intriguing when you get to see all walks of life, even if they aren't interested in you.
Kind of breaking up there, Anthony, but Anthony's saying he finds it intriguing meeting people from different walks of life, even in just brief conversations, Keo, and that's part of what it's all about.
I absolutely agree, yeah, and I think, you know, one thing, when you're walking around the world and you're talking to strangers, you are in this kind of open moment, and it really can spark your curiosity. And, you know, I feel like everybody needs more of that.
I used to hear from my friends who had visited Ireland often that they felt that Americans were bad at talking to strangers, but that in Ireland, everyone struck up conversations with people, and it was just what you did there, and it made for a more pleasant daily existence. Do you think there's something to that? Is there something about how Americans feel less comfortable talking to strangers?
Well, there are definitely different conventions in different countries and different cultures. I think that Americans tend to have a more awkward relationship to talking to strangers than people do in other cultures where it's just, you know, part of what everyone does. In the Middle East, for example, it would be considered rude not to say hello to a stranger. You know, you're likely to be invited back to someone's house for coffee if you ask them for directions. You know, in other places, in Germany, and these are wild generalizations, but, you know, they've been kind of confirmed to me and anecdotally expressed. In Germany, there are things that are more and less appropriate to ask a stranger. So if you're striking up a conversation with someone, we ask each other all the time in America, like, oh, what do you do for a living? And that would be quite rude. That would be like, why do you want to know? That's very nosy. But people are happy to talk about, like, logistical things. How did you get here to this party? You know, what, you know, did you take the subway or a car? How long did it take you? Was there traffic? Like, that's all fair game and reasonable territory.
We'll go back to our callers now. Darlene with us in Oshkosh. Darlene, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Darlene?
Well, I love talking to strangers, and so has my mother. And it is true, you got to make the eye contact. I smile. I get smiles in return. And sometimes, even in a checkout line, like after Christmas this year, there's a young gentleman behind me, and he's probably in his 30s, and I'm a grandma. And so we were talking because we made great eye contact. And eventually I asked him, well, what was your best Christmas gift, if you can share it? And he said, the birth of my son.
Wow.
Oh, I know. And it was just like, oh, my God, really? And then we started talking. And it was wonderful. I still have a warm feeling talking about that.
And now you have a story to share yourself, Darlene.
I do.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. Keo, yeah, we get these little, I don't know, vignettes, these little glimpses into other people's lives.
Well, and what I really love about that story is you asked such a great question. I mean, there are questions that give people an opportunity to tell you something really true and honest about themselves. And you hit on one of those kind of questions. What's the best present you got for Christmas? Is an invitation to tell a personal story. I love that.
Are there other good questions like that that you recommend?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It really depends on the situation. Like, that was a kind of brilliant situational question. I would rather ask somebody, like, what they had for lunch than ask them what they do for a living. When I meet somebody at, you know, some sort of formal event, I often ask them what they did today rather than ask them what they do for a living or what their job is or where they live. Because that, you know, chances are there's a story in what you did today. Even if it's one person said to me, like, you know, I answered emails all day. And I asked him at that point, what's your job? And he said, I'm a figurehead. He worked for a small company. you know, like, his job was just to be present and be the face of something. And we got in an interesting conversation about what that feels like. So that's one of my favorite things, is kind of taking the expected question and trying to open it up to allow something more personal.
Let's take another phone call here. We've got Amy on the line with us in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my husband and I both talk to strangers on a regular basis. I'll go for a walk in the parkway in the morning, and just as I'm passing somebody, I will say, good morning, and the look on their face of surprise that somebody actually said good morning to them. And then when they say good morning back to me, I kind of give myself a thumbs up, because it's kind of my goal to get somebody to say something back to me. Because in today's world, you know, people have tunnel vision, especially with their earbuds in and everything. And so it's like my personal goal that somebody says hello back to me. And it actually makes my day then, too. And my husband, no matter where he goes, he always strikes up a conversation with people. And it's sometimes in doing so, you find out what a small world this actually is, because he's come in with conversations with total strangers, and all of a sudden it's, well, where'd you go to high school? And then they tell each other, oh, did you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah, I've known them for years. And, you know, it's the 6 degrees of separation, I think that's what it is. And it's just kind of refreshing, and I just think it makes the world a kinder place. And when you make that eye contact, you take that edge off.
Amy, thanks for sharing all those experiences. So Amy's made it a goal in life to get people to respond to her, which makes me wonder, is this kind of hard, though? Do a lot of people not want to talk? Kyle?
I think that it really varies, again, by situation, but I agree that moment where someone is surprised and appreciative that you've said hello to them, that you've kind of recognized their humanity, is really wonderful. And when they return it, it's this moment of mutual recognition. And I think that's the tiny moments of this feeling of connectedness that I'm talking about. And it's so great to hear all these people talking about how much they love this. One thing that I also think about a lot is, again, for people who this is not second nature. And in When Strangers Meet, there's a series of what I call expeditions to give you a kind of contrivance to go out in the world and talk to people in different ways. And I think that those are in varying levels of difficulty. So they may be really fun also for people who do this all the time but want to push things further.
Thanks for the call, Amy. Talking to Keo Stark, author of the book When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. And we've got Ken with us next, calling from Madison. Ken, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Do you talk to strangers?
I do. I'm a little older than maybe some of your guests. I'm 68, and when I was growing up, that was just what you did. You know, you sat down on the bus or on the train or the plane. You were expected to talk to the person next to you because they didn't have cell phones and laptops. It was just the sort of thing that you did. And so I still expect to do that, but like last summer when I went to Brazil for the Olympics, I looked around the airport. Everybody there had their head down, and they're looking at their cell phone or their laptop. And it's really hard to strike up a conversation with somebody who's doing their best to, you know, ignore the rest of the world.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. And Keo, I'll admit, on a plane, I'll have a book ready to rock and look at it. And I think I may be doing it partly as a barrier to conversation. How do we overcome that? How do we put down the book or technology and open ourselves up to this?
Well, you know what? On a plane, I do the same thing. Like, you're stuck on a plane. If you open yourself up to having a conversation with someone and you find them really irritating, you've got a long plane ride ahead of you. So, you know, we definitely use conversation shields appropriately. But I think you do want to think about how much of the time you spend with your nose in your phone, and try to just promise yourself, all right, if you walk to work, you know, I'm going to walk 3 blocks with my phone in my pocket. I'm going to challenge myself. If I'm riding the bus, like, I'm going to not listen to my headphones and see how that feels and what happens. You know, we rely on these things to make us feel safe in a way, emotionally safe. And so it's a little bit of a risk to put them down, but I encourage everyone to give that a try.
Let's take one more quick call from Joan in Madison. Joan, hi.
Hi. I was just going to share that I'm the youngest of 5 girls in my family, and my sisters always tease me that I view the entire world as a friend waiting to happen. And they generally get irritated with me, and it makes me laugh because why wouldn't you want to say hello to, there's certain circumstances where you're not going to, but I guess it just makes me feel bad for them that they don't want to be out there talking to other people and perhaps meeting someone interesting. And then my comment or question was, in our children, my daughter will be different because of who I am, but with the way we raise our children and having fear of strangers and to be careful, do you see that this is going to become even more of a lost art?
Joan, thanks for that. And just a couple seconds for your response, Kyle.
I'm campaigning against it being a lost art. And I think, you know, we need to model for our children that it's okay to talk to strangers, and also what the boundaries are of appropriateness and safety.
We'll leave it there. Keo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're talking to Keo Stark. She's the author of the book When Strangers Meet, How People You Don't Know Can Transform You. On the Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to an article she wrote about talking to people while traveling in particular. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts and the stories you've heard, maybe, while talking to strangers.
We have an update for you on the City Hall contest with the Wisconsin community making it deep into the championships.
We talked last week to the village administrator for Little Chute, Wisconsin. That's in the Fox Valley. At that point, the Little Chute Village Hall was one of the eight finalists in an NCAA bracket-style competition. They were matched up against Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Little Chute won.
So Little Chute's Village Hall is in the Final Four now, facing off against Vancouver, Washington. As of a couple hours ago, Vancouver was ahead of Little Chute in the voting, just barely, by about 50 votes, with almost 6,000 total votes so far.
If Little Chute can pull this out, they're going to face either Peoria, Illinois, or Pasadena, California in the championships. So Little Chute's really gone a long way in this.
Final Four for Little Chute. That's amazing. And if you remember our conversation, I think the jewel in the crown of the Little Chute Village Hall is a functioning Dutch windmill.
Windmill in the sort of complex, plaza, they call it. Mm-hmm. That's right. So best of luck, Little Chute, in the voting. And we'll check in and let you know if they made it the rest of the way. This is Central Time.